We have this deeply comforting idea in our culture that if you just put in your time, you get the reward.
Oh, yeah. It's a very safe, very reassuring narrative.
Right. And I like to think of it as the punch card view of mastery. You clock in, you put your head down, you log your hours, and eventually a bell rings, and you are magically an expert.
It treats human skill acquisition like a basic savings account, basically. I mean, the assumption is that if you just keep making deposits of time, regardless of what you are actually doing during that time, the interest will automatically compound into genius.
But then you look at the reality of complex physical disciplines. And today, for this deep dive, we're using ice hockey as our primary lens, right? We're digging into a massive stack of source material on practice and motor learning and skill development.
And when you look at the real-world data there, that punch card machine is just completely broken.
Completely broken. I know people, and I'm sure you listening to this right now, know people too, who have logged thousands of hours at a skill, whether it's a sport or playing the guitar or even just public speaking.
And they are still making the exact same fundamental mistakes they made on day one.
Exactly. Which brings us to the core issue we need to tackle today. We are looking at the vast, unbridgeable difference between mindless repetition and true deliberate practice.
Because just accumulating time is an absolute illusion.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are going to go incredibly deep today. The mission here is to fundamentally rewire how you approach learning a complex motor skill.
Yeah, and we'll use hockey, but the mental models we are about to build apply to almost any difficult physical discipline you want to master.
Right, so we're going to dismantle a lot of myths, look at the uncomfortable reality of what the learning curve actually feels like biologically, and reprioritize what you should actually be practicing based on math rather than what just feels fun.
And we'll figure out how to optimize every second you spend training so you are building true functional intelligence. But we really have to start by taking a sledgehammer to the biggest roadblock of all,
The 10,000-hour
the
rule.
10,000-hour rule.
We all know it. Malcolm Gladwell made it famous in his book Outliers. It has essentially become the golden rule of expertise in modern culture. The idea is simple. Just hit 10,000 hours of practice, and boom, you become elite.
People treat it like a law of physics.
Yeah, they really do.
But it was never a scientific law. It was a popularization and, frankly, a massive misinterpretation of the data.
Walk me through where it actually came from.
So the number originally comes from a 1993 study of violinists. It was conducted by a researcher named K. Anders Ericsson. And Gladwell looked at Ericsson's study and saw that the best group of violinists in the cohort had accumulated roughly 10,000 hours of practice on average.
Wait, on average. That feels like a crucial caveat that just got completely lost in translation.
It's the entire point. It was just a group average by the time they were about 20 years old. It was never a magical threshold.
Right. Wasn't it guaranteed that if you cross 9,999 hours, you suddenly become a maestro?
Not at all. In fact, Ericsson himself spent years publicly rejecting how his number was being used by the media. His frustration was that the pop psychology version of his work just didn't distinguish between deliberate practice and just spending time doing an activity.
And the foundational myth actually gets worse, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because the scientific community eventually went back to check the math on that original violin study.
They did, yeah. In 2019, two researchers, McNamara and Matra, ran a direct double-blind replication of Ericsson's 1993 study.
Let me stop you there for a second because I want to make sure we are crystal clear on the mechanisms here. How on earth do you do a double-blind study on someone playing the violin?
It's a really good question.
Because, I mean, I understand double-blind in a drug trial. Right.
Yeah.
The doctor doesn't know if they're giving you the real pill or a sugar pill, and you don't know which one you were taking. But how does that work for a physical practice study?
Well, in a skill-based replication like this, double-blind means that the experts who are evaluating and rating the quality of the violinist's performances have absolutely no idea how many hours of practice those musicians have logged.
Oh, okay, so they were just listening to the audio.
Exactly. They just hear the audio. And conversely, the researchers who are collecting and crunching the practice logs don't know the performance scores.
Ah, so there is no subconscious bias where a judge might think, well, this kid practiced for 10,000 hours, so I should probably score them higher.
Precisely. You remove that human bias.
That makes perfect sense. So they blind the evaluators to the practice logs. What did they actually find when they ran it under these stricter conditions?
So they used a slightly larger group, 39 violinists instead of the original 30. And they found absolutely no statistically significant difference in accumulated solitary practice up to age 18 between the violinists rated as best and those rated as good.
Agree, none at all.
None. In fact, their descriptive observations noted a really fascinating detail. The majority of the violinists in the best category had actually accumulated less solitary practice time than the average amount logged by the merely good violinists.
Wow, so the entire foundation of the 10,000-hour rule, the whole idea that whoever logs the most hours becomes the best, just completely falls apart under rigorous blinded testing.
Yeah, it does, but we should read it as a null finding, not a total reversal. I mean, it doesn't mean practice is useless.
Right, obviously you have to practice.
Exactly. It simply means the specific claim that counting accumulated hours will neatly rank people by skill level is false. And we can actually zoom out even further to look at a massive meta-analysis published in 2016 by McNamara Moreau and Hambrick.
Okay, meta-analysis. So they are looking at a ton of studies at once.
Right. A meta-analysis is where researchers pull the data from dozens of different studies to find the broader truth. They looked at 63 different effect sizes across a bunch of sports.
Okay, let's translate effect size and variance for a layperson. When you say they were looking at effect sizes, what are we actually talking about?
Think of it this way. If you take 100 hockey players and rank them from the absolute best to the absolute worst, there is a massive gap of variance in their performance rate.
Yeah, a huge difference between the top and bottom.
So the researchers wanted to know how much of that gap is explained solely by the amount of deliberate practice they did. And their finding was that deliberate practice accounts for only about 18% of the variance in sports performance.
18%, that's it.
Yes, just 18%. And it gets even more stark. When they isolated just the elite adult athletes, the professionals' deliberate practice explained a statistically non-significant 1% of the variance between them.
Okay, let me push back on this heavily because this sounds incredibly depressing.
I know it does.
If this massive scientific review says deliberate practice only explains 18% of the difference between me and the guy next to me on the ice, why should you, the listener, even bother? If 82% of the outcome is completely out of your hands, why go through the agony of grueling training?
I completely understand why it feels discouraging at first glance, but you have to look at what that other 82% consists of.
What is in that 82%?
It's a massive mix of things: your genetics, your height, your fast twitch muscle fiber ratio, the age you happen to start playing, your access to elite coaching measurement error in the studies, and honestly, pure blind luck.
Right, so things you cannot control at all.
Exactly. You cannot change your genetics. You cannot time travel to put skates on when you were 4 years old. But practice, that 18% is a massive, massive lever, and it is the only variable that is entirely in your grip.
That's a great way to look at it.
You don't practice because it guarantees you will become an NHL all-star. You practice because it reliably moves you forward toward your own personal genetic ceiling.
That reframing is crucial. It's about maximizing personal potential, not guaranteeing a specific external outcome. But to actually pull that 18% lever, we have to know what deliberate practice actually is.
Right, because as we just established, merely logging hours doesn't work.
So the source material outlines K. Anders Ericsson's framework for what constitutes true deliberate practice. And it's built on five pillars. Let's break these down because understanding these five steps is the fundamental difference between wasting your time and actually improving.
Okay, so pillar one is a well-defined task with a specific goal. Most people go to the rink or the gym with a very vague intention.
Oh, yeah, totally.
They say, you know, I'm going to work on my shot today or I'm going to work on my skating. That is way too vague for the brain to process as a learning event.
It's like going to the library and saying, well, I'm going to learn today.
Exactly. True deliberate practice requires defining the exact parameters.
Yep.
You have to say, I am going to hit the far post from the top of the left face-off circle using my forehand receiving a pass from the corner 10 times in a row.
Wow. So it has to be ruthlessly measurable. You and an outside observer need to know exactly what success looks like on every single attempt.
Which feeds perfectly into pillar two, which is immediate feedback. You must know on this specific repetition whether it worked and, more importantly, why it worked or failed.
This is where I see people fail the most, and I've done this myself. You take a bucket of pucks, you dump them on the ice, and you just start blasting them at an empty net.
Right. And if you shoot 100 pucks into an empty net and you have no idea why 40 of them fluttered off the heel of your stick or missed the target entirely, you were not practicing. You were just rehearsing your errors.
Rehearsing your errors. That is a terrifying thought when you really pause to consider the biology of it. Let's talk about the mechanisms of learning for a second.
Let's do it.
When we repeat a physical movement, our nervous system responds by wrapping a fatty substance called myelin around the neural pathway, firing that movement right.
Yes, the myelin sheath. It acts like insulation on a copper electrical wire. The more you fire a specific circuit, say a specific wrist shot motion, the thicker the myelin gets.
And the thicker the myelin gets, the faster and stronger the electrical signal travels down that pathway. So the movement becomes automatic.
But here's the catch. The myelin doesn't know if your wrist shot is good or bad.
Right. It is completely agnostic. It just insulates whatever you repeat.
Exactly. So if you are out there doing 100 repetitions with terrible mechanics and you have no feedback telling you it's terrible, you are literally biologically hardwiring a bad habit into your nervous system. You are building a superhighway for a mistake.
That is so dangerous.
It is precisely the danger. A repetition without feedback is worse than useless. It is actively destructive. And that brings us to pillar 3. Operating at the edge of your ability.
Meaning it has to be hard.
Beyond hard. You have to work just beyond what you can currently do reliably. If you are succeeding on 95% of your repetitions, you are not practicing.
You're just performing.
You are performing. You are just stroking your own ego. True practice requires a high failure rate because failure is the exact signal the brain needs to adapt.
And when you fail, you hit pillar 4. Which is correction and repetition.
Right. You get the immediate feedback, you know, I missed wide left because my hands were too close to my body. Then you correct that one specific mechanical flaw. You try again and you keep what works.
And the final pillar, pillar 5.
Design and instruction from an outside source. This is the one amateurs universally skip because it costs money or it requires vulnerability.
Why is it so necessary, though?
Because you literally cannot see your own skating stride. You cannot feel that your shoulders are hunched because your internal proprioception, your sense of your body in space, is deeply flawed.
Because your brain thinks you're doing it right, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it that way.
Exactly. You need a coach, a highly skilled training partner, or at the absolute minimum, your smartphone set up on a tripod. An outside eye is absolutely required to set the tasks and provide the objective feedback you physically cannot give yourself.
Okay, let's pause and do a quick retrieval check for you, the listener. What should we remember from this first segment? What is the core difference between mindless repetition and deliberate practice?
It's feedback.
Yes, feedback. If you are in the driveway or on the ice and you cannot tell if a rep was good or bad, stop immediately. Do not do another rep until you fix your feedback loop. Otherwise, you're just rehearsing your errors.
And once you understand how to practice, we have to prepare you for what progress actually feels like. Because biologically and psychologically, it does not feel good. It's not feel like a smooth upward curve.
Yeah, we all have this romantic mental model of learning, right? We picture it as a beautiful sweeping curve upward on a graph. You might have seen it in textbooks called Power Law of Practice.
Yep, you put in time on the x-axis and your skill goes up smoothly on the y-axis.
You get a little bit better every single day.
But the source material is absolutely adamant that smooth curve is a complete myth.
Why is it a myth? I mean, textbooks have printed it for decades.
It is an artifact of bad statistics. It comes from averaging data across hundreds or thousands of people. If you take 500 people learning a skill and average their progress, the mathematical average creates a smooth curve.
Oh, so it just smooths out the bumps.
Exactly. But if you zoom in on any single individual in that study, their personal learning curve looks nothing like that. Individual learning curves are actually staircases.
Staircases, meaning flat lines and then sudden jumps.
Yes. They are characterized by long, incredibly frustrating plateaus where nothing seems to happen for weeks, followed by sudden breakthroughs and occasionally terrifying drops in performance.
Let's diagnose those plateaus. Because if you are a driven person and you hit a wall where you aren't getting better, your instinct is just to grind harder.
Yeah.
You know, you say, I'll just put in more hours.
But if you don't know why you're stuck, grinding harder might be the worst thing you can do.
Right. And the outline identifies 4 main causes for a learning plateau. Let's go through them.
The first cause is actually positive. It's called consolidation. Your brain and nervous system are just making the new skill automatic.
So you are improving, but it doesn't look like it.
Right. During this phase, it stops feeling like you are improving because the cognitive load is shifting from your conscious prefrontal cortex into your subconscious. You aren't getting better in terms of output, but your brain is getting more efficient. This plateau resolves on its own with patience.
Okay, so for that one, just wait it out. What's the second cause?
hitting the ceiling of a flawed technique, you have optimized a bad movement pattern as far as it can possibly go.
Give me an example of that.
Imagine typing on a keyboard with only your two index fingers. You can get pretty fast doing that. You can optimize it. But eventually, you will hit a speed limit that you can never surpass because the underlying technique is fundamentally flawed.
And the only way up is to tear it down and rebuild it using all 10 fingers, which is painful.
Very painful, which we will get to in a moment. The third cause of a plateau is coasting. You are no longer operating at the edge of your ability. You're just going to the rink and practicing what you can already do because it feels comfortable and it feeds your ego to look good in front of other people. This is by far the most common cause of stagnation in adult amateurs.
That makes a lot of sense. And the fourth cause?
A hidden limiter. This is a really fascinating biomechanical issue. You might think your wrist shot has plateaued because your hand speed is maxed out. So you spend hours working on your hands.
But the real issue is somewhere else.
Exactly. The hidden limiter is actually your balance on your skates. You can't generate more power with your hands because your core and your legs are completely unstable. You are diagnosing the wrong problem.
Let's go back to that second cause for a minute, hitting the ceiling of a flawed technique. Because fixing that leads to one of the most counterintuitive and frustrating concepts in motor learning, the worse before better phenomenon.
To understand this, we have to look at the research by Soderstrom and Bjork, published in 2015. They drew a vital, scientifically rigorous distinction between learning and performance.
We tend to think they are the same thing, but they are not.
They are completely different. How well you perform during a specific practice session is a terrible indicator of how much you actually learned.
Walk me through that. If I have a fantastic practice session, I'm energized.
Yeah.
I'm nailing every single drill perfectly. Didn't I learn a lot?
No. If you nailed every drill perfectly, you likely learned absolutely nothing.
Wow.
You were merely performing a skill you already own. You weren't failing, which means you weren't forcing your nervous system to adapt. But when you are truly learning, specifically when you are tearing down a flawed technique to rebuild it, your performance will drop immediately and severely.
Because you are fighting those old myelin pathways we talked about.
Exactly. Imagine a coach is changing your skating stride. Your old stride was too narrow, but it was reliable. You had heavily myelinated that narrow stance.
Where your body knows exactly how to do it.
Now the coach wants you to take a wider stance. You are essentially throwing away a well-grooved, reliable, but low-ceiling motor pattern and replacing it with a raw, unpolished, high-ceiling motor pattern.
So it's going to look awful.
For a period of time, as you try to wire this new pathway, you are going to be objectively worse at skating than you were the day before you started.
I love this concept. I like to think of it like switching your computer keyboard layout. Most of us use the standard QWERTY layout. It was literally designed in the 1800s to slow typists down so mechanical typewriters wouldn't jam.
Right, it's intentionally inefficient.
Exactly. Now, there is an alternative called the Dvorak layout, which places all the most common vowels and consonants right under your home fingers. It is scientifically proven to be a much faster, more efficient system for the human hand.
That is a perfect analogy for changing a physical technique.
But think about what happens if you decide to switch to Dvorak today. Even though it is a superior system, if you switch your keys right now, your typing speed is going to absolutely plummet.
Oh, yeah. You will go from 80 words a minute down to 10 words a minute.
You will feel like an absolute idiot hunting and pecking for the letter A. If you judge your learning by your words per minute on day 3, you will conclude that Dvorak is a complete disaster and you will quit and go back to QWERTY.
And in hockey coaching, that quitting happens in a very specific, predictable window. Coaches refer to it as the 2 to 5 week danger zone.
Let's break down the anatomy of that danger zone. What exactly is happening in the player's brain and body during those weeks?
So week 1, the coach changes your technique. Let's say it's your grip on the stick. It feels physically awful. Your prefrontal cortex is working in overdrive, consciously managing every micro movement. You are slow and clumsy.
Okay, then week 2.
Week 2, it feels slightly less awful, but you are still demonstrably worse than you were with your old grip.
You are in the deepest part of the dip.
Then usually around week 3, you have an actual competitive game.
Yeah.
The puck comes to you, an opponent is rushing at you to hit you. Under the intense time pressure and stress of a live game, your prefrontal cortex gets totally overwhelmed.
Your brain panics.
It panics? And what does it do? It reverts to the old, heavily myelinated, faster motor pattern. The player gets off the ice frustrated and says, "See, this new technique doesn't work for me in real games." And they abandon it.
Right in that window. between week two and week five.
Which is a complete tragedy of human biology, because week five is typically the exact moment just before the new neural pathway would have finished consolidating, become automatic, and started wildly outperforming the old technique. They quit 3 feet from gold.
So practically speaking, for the listener, how do you survive the danger zone without quitting?
You need three psychological defenses. First, you must decide the change is permanent before you start, and you set a review date 2 months out, not 2 weeks out. You commit to the dip.
You have to know it's going to suck.
Exactly. Second, you must aggressively separate practice from performance.
What does that mean in action?
It means you use the new uncomfortable technique in every single practice drill, no matter how bad you look. But you give yourself explicit permission to survive using your old technique during live games for the first month.
Oh, okay, so don't try to force it when it counts yet.
Right, you cannot expect to change your fundamental biomechanics mid-game while someone is trying to tackle you. Let the practice reps do the rewiring.
That is so freeing. And the third defense.
Judge your learning on a cold retention test, not on how the practice session felt in the moment.
A cold retention test, testing yourself later. This brings up a really fascinating piece of cognitive science from the source material regarding the testing effect. This is heavily based on Roediger and Karpik's famous 2006 study on how the human brain retains information.
The testing effect is incredibly powerful, but it is also widely misunderstood when people try to apply it to sports. Let's look at the 2006 study first. Roediger and Karpik proved that actively testing yourself, what they call retrieval practice, is vastly superior to simply rereading or reviewing information.
They tested this on university students, right?
Yes. They took one group of students and had them read a prose passage 4 times. A week later, they tested them. That group recalled about 40% of the information.
Okay, 40%. And the second group?
They took a second group, had them read the passage just once, but then tested them on it 3 times. No rereading, just forcing their brains to retrieve the answers. A week later, that second group recalled 61% of the information.
That is a massive jump in retention.
It is. Roland ran a massive meta-analysis on this in 2014 and found a moderate to large effect size of 0.50 for testing over restudying. The cognitive mechanism is that the act of struggling to produce an answer cued recall strengthens the neural pathways far more than just passively recognizing the information when you read it again.
So the takeaway seems to be test yourself constantly. But there is a massive trap here for hockey players and athletes in general, isn't there?
A huge trap with 2 major caveats. First, even in cognitive learning, the testing effect collapses to 0 if you test yourself, get the answer wrong, and do not receive immediate feedback with the correct answer.
Because otherwise you're just confidently remembering the wrong answer.
Exactly. Testing only works if you fix the errors. But the second caveat is the most important for us today. Every single robust study proving the testing effect used verbal or declarative material. Prose passages, historical dates, trivia word pairs, cognitive tasks.
Things you memorize with your conscious mind.
Precisely. To date, there is very little proof that the testing effect applies to a complex motor skill like a skating stride or a golf swing. You cannot quiz your muscles into better biomechanics.
Right, you can't just think your way to a better slap shot. So how should the listener apply this?
You use the testing effect to learn the systems, the rules, the positional tactics, and the theory of the sport. If you need to memorize a defensive zone coverage system, read it once and then draw it out on a whiteboard from memory 3 times. That will work beautifully.
But for the physical stuff?
Do not expect a written test to magically groove your physical wrist shot. For motor skills, we have to rely on the misery of deliberate practice failure and fizzle feedback.
Okay, let's summarize where we are. We know progress requires enduring the misery of the dip. We know how to structure deliberate practice with feedback. We know we shouldn't judge our learning by how we feel in the moment. But this raises the most practical question of all. What specific physical skills should we actually suffer through?
Oh, we have limited time, right? So what do we practice?
Exactly. And this is where we run into a major human behavioral flaw. The answer to what you should practice is almost always the exact opposite of what human nature wants to do.
It's so true.
I call this the fun versus value inverse correlation. Let's look at a typical amateur hockey practice or an open ice session. What is every single person doing? They are shooting the puck.
They practice shooting the most because it is intrinsically fun. It provides a dopamine hit. It's also private. You are just interacting with the net. And it provides instant satisfying binary feedback. The puck goes in or it doesn't.
And what do they practice the least?
Skating. Specifically deep edge work and balance. Because skating drills are agonizing. They make your quadriceps burn.
And they're embarrassing.
Highly embarrassing. Crucially, if you push yourself to the edge of your ability in skating, you're going to fall down, which means you are going to look like a beginner in public in front of your peers. The adult ego hates that.
But when we look at the source material and consult high-level coaches, the value of those skills is flipped entirely upside down. Let's break down the priority list from a coaching perspective, starting with number one. And it wins by a mile.
Priority number one is skating. It is the fundamental multiplier of the sport. It is the only skill you use every single second of every single shift you are on the ice.
Explain why it's a multiplier. Why does my skating make my hands better?
Because every other skill is capped by the stability of your skating platform.
Yeah.
Think about the biomechanics. A wrist shot taken while you are standing completely still on flat ice is a fundamentally different physical action than a wrist shot taken while you are moving at 15 miles an hour, transferring your weight from your back leg to your front leg on a quarter-inch strip of steel.
The physics change entirely.
Completely. If you improve your skating specifically, your knee bends your command of your outside edges and your ability to stop violently in both directions. Your passing, your shooting, and your defending all automatically improve.
Why does shooting improve if I'm just working on my feet?
Because you are operating from a more stable base, and Ooh. Because superior skating buys you an extra half second of time in a game, and time is everything.
So priority one is skating. Prioritize the pain. Priority number two, puck handling. But the source material puts a massive asterisk next to this.
The asterisk is head up. The cognitive skill of puck handling in a game environment is not simply moving a piece of vulcanized rubber back and forth on your stick. Mm. A dog can be trained to push a puck around.
True.
The actual functional skill is moving the puck while visually tracking something else.
Because if your head is down, you aren't playing hockey. You're just doing a solo juggling act in the middle of a war zone.
Precisely. If you can stick handle beautifully, but your eyes are glued to your blade, you are a player who cannot stick handle in a game. You will not see the 200-pound defender coming to hit you. You will not see the open passing lane, and you cannot read the goalie. The skill only counts if the visual field is decoupled from the motor action.
Which total sense. Okay, priority three, passing and receiving. And specifically, the coaches point out that we completely ignore the most important half of this equation.
We obsess over making great passes, and we completely ignore the skill of receiving them. If you watch video or amateur hockey, most turnovers are not the result of a fundamentally bad pass.
No.
No, they are the result of a mathematically decent pass hitting a rigid, unyielding stick blade and bouncing 2 feet away into an opponent's skates.
I am so guilty of this.
Yeah.
You tense up, you grip the stick tight, and the puck just ricochets off you.
You have to practice soft hands. A pass received cleanly in stride, cushioned, and moved in one touch is the most destructive thing you can do to a defensive structure because the puck moves infinitely faster through the air than human beings can physically skate.
Right, you can't outskate a pass.
If you can receive a puck on your backhand while moving, you change the entire geometry of the rink.
Which brings us to dead last on the priority list. Priority number four.
Shooting.
The thing everyone spends 90% of their practice time doing is objectively, mathematically, the least important skill to practice. I really want to spend some time on this because the possession math from the source material absolutely blew my mind. Walk us through the USA Hockey study.
In 2002, USA Hockey ran a comprehensive puck possession study. They took stopwatches and video cameras to the Olympic Winter Games and the Youth National Championships.
Just to track puck time.
Yeah. Their goal was to track how long individual specific players actually held the puck on their stick during a standard 60-minute hockey game.
Okay, so they are tracking the actual time of physical possession. The puck is literally touching their blade.
Right. They tracked every level from 12 and under kids all the way up to Olympic professionals, and across every single demographic, the numbers were staggering. The maximum average possession time per player in a 60-minute game was 1 minute and 12 seconds.
Wait, 1 minute and 12 seconds out of 60 minutes?
And that 1 minute, 12 seconds was the women's Olympic per game average. The men's Olympic average was actually slightly lower at 1 minute and 7 seconds because the men's game has more dump and chase tactics. Hmm. A youth player is usually under a minute.
Let's do the math out loud for the listener to really drive this home. Mm-hmm. You are on the ice actively playing for maybe 15 to 20 minutes of a 60-minute game, depending on your shift length, right?
Yeah.
Of those 15 minutes, you are physically on the ice. The puck is on your stick for 60 seconds. You're going to take, what, maybe 4 or 5 shots in the entire game?
At most.
So what does this all mean? The aha moment here is just staggering. You will skate for 60 minutes. You will hold the puck for 60 seconds. Therefore, spending your limited expensive practice time shooting 500 pucks instead of doing painful skating edge work is mathematically absurd.
It's completely absurd.
You are training for the 1% of the game at the expense of the 99%.
It is an entirely backward allocation of resources. Now, obviously, you still need to know how to shoot. But the coaching advice to manage human behavior is this: front load the painful, valuable skating edge work at the very beginning of your session.
Eat your vegetables first.
Exactly. Do it while you still have willpower and physical energy. You earn the dopamine hit and the fun of shooting by doing the miserable skating work first.
Let's do a quick periodic review recap for you listening right now. Audit your own practice time. Are you prioritizing skating and receiving over shooting? Are you ensuring every single puck handling rep is done with your eyes up, looking away from the puck?
Because if you are just going to the rink and doing what's fun, you are probably not improving. You're just having a good time, which is fine, but it isn't deliberate practice.
Which brings us to the next massive trap. Because ice time is incredibly scarce, it's cold, it requires a specialized building, and it costs hundreds of dollars an hour. Players naturally try to compensate by practicing off the ice, in their driveway, in their garage, or on a tennis court.
It makes total sense. Get the reps in wherever you can.
It makes logical sense, but the human brain is incredibly literal. Not everything you do in sneakers on asphalt translates to what you do on steel blades on a sheet of frozen water.
This is the transferability trap. We have to look at the specificity principle, or what sports science researchers call representative learning design.
Representative learning design. What is that?
This concept was heavily formalized by researchers Pinder, Davids, Renshaw, and Araujo in 2011. The core premise is that practice only transfers to the real game if it reproduces the specific demands and the specific information of the real task.
The information. Break that down for me.
It means you can't just mimic the raw physical movement of a sport in a vacuum. You have to mimic the informational constraints of the environment, the visual cues, the friction of the surface, the timing, the presence of defenders.
Because if you don't.
If the environment is too different, the brain learns a completely separate motor pattern that won't activate when you get back on the real ice.
Let's make this highly practical. Let's run through the common off-ice tools people buy and use and rank them based on what genuinely transfers to the ice and what is a waste of time. Let's start high on the list, stick handling a golf ball or a specialized green biscuit puck on a smooth floor.
High transfer value. Your hands, wrists, and forearms do very nearly the exact same biomechanical thing off the ice as they do on the ice. It costs almost nothing and the return on investment is high. But we must return to the asterisk. You must ruthlessly enforce the head-up rule.
How do you do that alone in a garage?
Put a television on and force yourself to track the action on the screen while you handle the ball. Or stick pieces of paper with random numbers on the wall in front of you and constantly call out the numbers as you look around.
So you have to be processing visual info.
Right. 15 minutes of stick handling with your head up is infinitely more valuable than 3 hours of complex toe drags while staring down at your sneakers.
Also in the high-value category, wall passing and rebounders. You know those heavy rubber bands you pass a puck into?
Highly underrated. 10 minutes of passing a heavy puck against a concrete wall gives you hundreds of pass receptions with instant kinetic feedback. And since we know from the priority list that receiving is the neglected half of passing, the volume you get here is pure gold.
But the specificity principle applies here too, right?
Yes. The caveat is that a flat wall returns a flat, mathematically perfect pass right back onto your forehand every single time. Real hockey games never give you perfect passes.
They're always bouncing.
Real games give you wobbling, bouncing pucks in your skates on your backhand while you are moving. So when you use a wall, you have to deliberately manufacture messiness. Change your angle. Force yourself to receive it on your backhand. Intentionally pass it poorly so it bounces back weirdly. Simulate the messiness of reality.
What about the expensive stuff? Synthetic ice tiles and those slippery plastic slide boards where you wear booties and slide side to side.
Slide boards are genuinely great for training the specific lateral pushing muscles of the groin and the recovery of the leg back underneath your center of mass. Running doesn't train that lateral motion, but a slide board does not train your balance on a steel edge, which is the hardest part of skating.
And synthetic ice, the plastic sheets you can actually skate on.
It's good for edgework mechanics, but you have to understand the physics. Synthetic ice has a significantly higher friction coefficient than real ice. Your glide is much shorter, it requires more muscular effort to move, and it dulls your steel blades incredibly rapidly.
So it's harder to skate on.
It is. It's a good tool, but if you spend all summer on plastic, your timing will be off when you hit real ice because you will suddenly have much more glide.
Now let's look at the danger zone. Things that transfer less than advertised. The outline calls this the correlation trap.
This is fascinating. There was a recent study by Rice and colleagues in 2024. They looked at a battery of off-ice fitness tests, sprints, jumps, agility, and compared them to on-ice performance in youth hockey players.
And what did they find?
They found exactly what you would expect. Fast runners are usually fast skaters. People with high vertical jump power are usually explosive accelerators on the ice.
So the conclusion is go run sprints, right?
No, that is the trap. It is a correlation, not causation. Fast runners are fast skaters because they happen to have a genetic predisposition for fast twitch muscle fibers.
Meaning just because fast skaters happen to be fast runners, it doesn't mean that the act of practicing running will magically optimize your skating mechanics.
Exactly. The classic universally misused example is the agility ladder. You see athletes stepping rapidly in and out of a rope ladder on the ground to get quick feet.
I see youth hockey teams doing this for hours.
Let's look at the biomechanics. An agility ladder trains rapid, tiny vertical steps on the balls of your feet. But a hockey skating stride is the exact opposite. It is a long, heavy, horizontal lateral push driving down through your heel onto a steel edge.
The motions are completely different.
The motor patterns barely overlap. Training agility ladders might be a decent cardiovascular warm-up, but on the grounds of specificity, it is a terrible tool for improving the mechanics of a skating stride. You are getting better at ladders, not skating.
The source material also points out a massive debate in the hockey community around roller hockey and inline skating during the summer.
It's highly contested among coaches. On one hand, roller hockey is incredible for your hands, your passing, and your cognitive decision making because it is usually played 4-on-4 in tight, restrictive spaces. It forces you to read the game.
But for the physical act of skating,
that's where the debate lies. Polyurethane wheels grip concrete or sport court entirely differently than a steel edge cuts into ice. You physically cannot execute a true parallel 2-foot hockey stop on wheels without violently wiping out. You have to use dragging stops or tight turns.
So the mechanics change.
Right. Some purist ice coaches argue that roller hockey ruins your ice mechanics and you waste the first month of the winter season relearning how to stop and trust your edges. Other coaches say the crossover benefits outweigh the mechanical differences. There is no definitive empirical study settling it yet.
So what's the verdict for the listener?
The safe bet, play roller hockey for the cardiovascular conditioning and the hockey IQ, but do not count it as pure technical skating practice. And fully expect your first day back on the real ice to feel very weird.
Which brings us to the ultimate danger of all this off-ice practice, the unlearning problem. This is where it gets scary, because sometimes doing off-ice drills is actually worse than sitting on your couch doing nothing.
This is a serious biomechanical and neurological caution. If you do an off-ice drill improperly, you are not just wasting time, you are actively grooving a harmful compensation.
Let's bring the neuroscience back in here. Let's talk about the basal ganglia.
The basal ganglia is a group of structures deep within the brain that handles habit formation and automated motor behaviors. When you first learn a skill, your prefrontal cortex, the conscious thinking part of your brain, is in charge. It's slow and clumsy.
But then it shifts.
Yeah, as you repeat a movement and myelinate the pathway, the control of that movement shifts down to the basal ganglia. It becomes an automatic habit.
Like driving a car.
Yeah.
You know, you don't think about turning the steering wheel anymore.
Exactly. But here's the catch. The basal ganglia is not a moral judge. It doesn't know if a habit is technically correct or incorrect. It just stores whatever movement you repeat the most.
So if I spend all summer in my garage doing 10,000 reps of stick handling a golf ball, but I do it while staring straight down at my sneakers.
You have permanently wired a head-down reflex into your basal ganglia. You have automated a critical error.
And why is that so dangerous in a game? Can't I just tell myself, okay, I'm in a game now, keep my head up?
Because under the intense stress, fatigue, and time pressure of a live game, your prefrontal cortex essentially shuts down. Cognitive load maxes out. In a crisis, humans do not rise to the occasion. They sink to the level of their automated basal ganglia patterns.
So you just revert.
The second an opponent pressures you, your head will automatically snap down to look at the puck because that is the reflex you built.
And getting hit with your head down is how you end up with a concussion.
Yes. And from a learning perspective, you will now have to spend months consciously, actively unlearning this harmful habit. Unlearning an automated motor pattern is significantly harder than learning it from scratch. Your performance will plummet while you try to overwrite the bad code.
So sitting on the couch would have been better for your development than practicing wrong?
Objectively, yes.
I have a very specific question on this off-ice training. What if I am doing it perfectly? What if I am practicing a movement, say a toe drag slowly, with perfect mechanics?
Yeah.
My head is up, but I'm doing it at a pace that is completely comfortable and easy for me. Am I doing myself a disservice?
Yes, you are. Because motor skills are highly speed specific.
Meaning my brain remembers the speed, not just the motion.
Exactly. The neural firing pattern required to execute a physical movement at 60% speed is different from the pattern required at 100% speed. If you only ever train a skill slowly because it feels comfortable and you don't make mistakes, you only own that skill at 60% speed.
So when I get into a game and have to do it at a dead sprint,
the skill will instantly disintegrate. The brain doesn't know how to fire the muscles in that sequence at that velocity. You must push yourself to the edge of failure in practice. You have to practice faster than you can control cleanly. It will look messy, but that is how the nervous system adapts to speed.
Okay, we have thoroughly audited off-ice practice. Let's transition to how most teams completely waste their actual expensive on-ice time. Let's talk about the dead air of traditional drills.
To understand the inefficiency of traditional coaching, let's do the mathematics of the cue. Visualize a standard full ice breakout drill that you see at almost every amateur practice.
Okay, so the coach blows the whistle, one guy skates down the ice, gets a pass, and shoots.
Right. You have one player out in the middle of the ice executing the physical repetition. But look at the rest of the team. You have 5, maybe 10 players standing in a line against the sideboards doing absolutely nothing, just waiting for their turn.
That is a terrifying ratio of action to inaction.
If you run the stopwatch on a standard practice, it means that nearly 50% of a typical 60-minute team practice is spent standing completely still in a queue. You are paying hundreds of dollars an hour for ice time to stand still in a freezer.
So as a player, if you are stuck in a poorly designed practice and you are standing in that line, how do you salvage that time? How do you prevent it from being completely wasted?
There are 3 highly practical tips here. First, do not lean on your stick like it is a medical crutch.
Why does that matter?
Because of the basal ganglia again. If you spend 30 minutes of practice resting your weight on your stick with one hand, you are building a physical habit of having a lazy, unengaged stick. In a game, your stick needs to be on the ice in 2 hands, ready to intercept a pass. Don't build a lazy habit in line.
Okay, tip 2.
Keep your feet moving. Small circles, shifting weight. Standing completely still in a freezing rink for 4 minutes, and then suddenly being asked to execute an explosive 100% effort sprint is the precise biomechanical recipe for pulling a groin muscle or tearing a hip flexor. Keep the blood flowing.
And the 3rd tip.
Mentally engage. Watch the player taking the repetition in front of you. Actively name out loud or in your head what you would do differently based on the coach's instructions.
Give me an example.
You know, you watch a guy go and you think his hands were too tight. He didn't shoulder check. Mental imagery and cognitive engagement activate the same motor cortex pathways as physical movement, just to a lesser degree. It is free repetition.
But the real fix isn't just surviving the cue. The real fix is for coaches to fundamentally change how practice is structured, which introduces the overwhelming superiority of small area games, or SAGs.
The concept of a small area game is simple. You shrink the space and you cut the numbers. Instead of playing a 5-on-5 scrimmage using the entire 200-foot ice sheet, you take out some rink dividers and play a 3-on-3 game strictly confined to the area below the face-off circles in one end zone.
Why does shrinking the ice work so much better?
First, it's sheer volume. Going back to that USA hockey study, we know a player gets maybe 1 minute of puck possession in a full ice game. By shrinking the ice and reducing the players to 3-on-3, every single player's puck touches and physical engagements multiply exponentially.
But it's not just about getting more reps, is it? It fundamentally changes what you are practicing.
Exactly. It trains the critical cognitive skills that traditional linear drills literally remove from the equation.
What do you mean by that? What does a drill remove?
A standard drill removes unpredictability. It removes the opponent. If I tell you to skate to the red cone pivot and pass to the coach, you know the answer to the test before you even start moving. There is 0 cognitive load.
You're just a robot executing a script.
But a small area game forces you to read a live, chaotic, unpredictable opponent under intense time and spatial pressure. It forces you to time your support for your teammates dynamically rather than just skating to a predetermined spot on the ice. It trains deception. It trains how to create physical separation in a tiny, confined space.
And the compete level too, right?
Crucially, yes, it trains their compete level because there is actually a live puck to fight for and a score being kept.
I love this concept. I like to use a music analogy here. A traditional drill, you know, skating around cones is like practicing scales on a piano. A small area game is like sitting in on a live jazz jam session.
That's a perfect way to look at it.
You absolutely need to know your scales. You need the underlying technique. But sitting in your bedroom playing scales up and down will never, ever teach you how to actually play music with other human beings reacting in real-time improvising when someone hits a wrong note.
That is an excellent analogy. The drill builds the biological capability. The game builds the real-world application.
Now, you are a scientist at heart, so I know you want to fact-check the enthusiasm around small area games with the actual literature.
Yes, to maintain intellectual rigor, the source material notes that we need to be honest about the academic evidence. Coaches universally believe that small area games build better tactical decision-making. It is logically very sound.
But what do the studies say?
If we look at formal studies like Clemente's massive 2021 systematic review of small-sided games and sports, the scientific literature primarily proves technical and physiological benefits.
Meaning they prove it gets you in better shape and improves your hands.
Right. The actual measurable tactical and decision-making benefits are technically under-tested in the academic literature. It's incredibly hard to quantify decision-making in a double-blind study. So we know SAGs work practically, but the specific undeniable academic proof for cognitive gains in hockey is surprisingly thin.
But practically speaking, for a player on the ice, the jazz jam session is where the magic happens. And this analogy leads perfectly into our next major pillar. Let's talk about building hockey IQ and the science of decision making.
This might be the core insight of the entire deep dive today. We have to definitively separate having a skill from knowing when to use it. Skill is merely a physical capability. Hockey IQ is a cognitive selection between capabilities executed under intense time pressure.
Let that sink in for a second. The highest skilled player is rarely the most effective player.
Because a physical skill executed at the wrong tactical moment is worse than worthless. Let's say you have the silkiest hands in the world. You have practiced toe drags for 10,000 hours. You execute a biomechanically perfect toe drag.
But you do it at the wrong time.
Right. You do it at your own blue line as the last man back and a defender pokes the puck away. You just caused a breakaway against your own goalie. That is a catastrophic error caused by high skill and incredibly low hockey IQ.
Standard drills build the skill, but as we discussed, they completely ignore the selection process. In a drill, there is no read. So if I'm a coach running a practice or I'm a player organizing an open ice session, how do I fix an execution-only drill?
It's remarkably simple. You add one variable. You add a single token passive defender.
Just one guy standing there. He doesn't even have to tackle you.
He doesn't have to tackle you. He just has to be a passive obstacle who is allowed to randomly take away exactly one option. Let's say it's a two-on-one drill. The passive defender is instructed to either stand in the passing lane or pressure the shooter. He chooses randomly on each rep.
So the player with the puck doesn't know the answer in advance.
Exactly. Immediately, the player with the puck cannot just execute a script. They have to keep their head up, process the visual information of the defender's body language, and make a decision. The pass is taken away. Okay, I have to compete that and shift to a shot.
That one passive defender transforms the drill from mindless physical execution into vital cognitive training.
And if you really want to accelerate that cognitive training, the source material is emphatic about one specific technological tool. You have to use video review.
If we connect this all the way back to the bigger picture of Erickson's deliberate practice, remember pillar 5, you need an outside eye for objective feedback. Video is the cheapest, most ruthless, and most accurate outside eye available.
And why is video so critical for hockey specifically?
Well, because of the possession math we did earlier, right?
Yes. You play 96% of a 5-on-5 game completely without the puck.
That is wild to think about. 96%.
If you only judge your performance by what you do during the 60 seconds, the puck is physically on your stick. You are entirely ignoring 96% of your performance. Video review lets you pause the game and evaluate your spacing, your support routes, your defensive reads, and your body language when you don't have the puck.
But how should a player actually use video? Because when I watch video of myself, I just watch the puck. I watch it like I'm watching a game on TV on a Sunday afternoon.
That is the fundamental mistake. You are watching for entertainment, not analyzing for data. First, you need to film from as high up in the stands as possible. You need to see the entire structural system of the players, not just a zoomed-in shot of the puck.
And what am I looking for?
You shouldn't just watch passively. You need to approach the video with one specific measurable question. For example, you ask, did I physically turn my head and shoulder check to scan the ice before I received a pass? Then you watch every single shift, and you literally tally the yes or no answers on a piece of paper.
Which brings us to a massive psychological shift for athletes measuring process versus measuring outcomes.
The score sheet at the end of a game is mostly noise, especially in an amateur season. Goals and assists are outcome measures. They depend heavily on the skill of the opposing goalie, the competence of your line mates, the referee, and pure random luck with how the puck bounces.
You could play a terrible game and get two assists because your teammate made an incredible shot.
Or you could play a perfect game, make six brilliant passes, and your teammates miss the empty net every time. If you judge yourself by assists, you will think you played poorly. A process measure, however, is totally in your control.
Give me some process measures.
How many times did I successfully make the first pass out of the defensive zone? Did I stop on the net on every rush? Track the process, and the outcomes will eventually take care of themselves.
All right, this is all incredible theory, the cognitive science, the math, the practice structures. But let's ground this in reality. Let's talk about the adult beginner. How does an adult, someone with a full-time job, a family, a mortgage, and a nagging knee injury, actually apply all this deliberate practice without getting hurt and quitting?
We have to be brutally honest about the adult learner profile because it is entirely different from teaching a 10-year-old. There are severe physical and psychological disadvantages to learning a motor skill as an adult.
Let's start with the physical, the fear of falling.
First and foremost, adults weigh significantly more than children. We fall from a higher center of gravity. The kinetic impact of a 200-pound man hitting the ice is exponentially higher than a 60-pound child.
And crucially, we have the psychological burden of knowing we have to go to work on Monday morning.
Right, to pay our mortgage. A child doesn't worry about missing a day of fourth grade because of a bruised hip.
And that fear isn't just in your head. It literally ruins your physical technique, doesn't it?
Yes. This is a vital biomechanical point. The subconscious fear of falling makes the human body stand up straight. We lock our joints to feel secure. But in hockey, standing with straight legs is the root anatomical cause of almost every single skating flaw.
Because you have no balance.
Exactly. When your legs are straight, your center of gravity is high, and you cannot engage the edges of your skate blades into the ice at the proper angle, you are essentially teetering on a tightrope.
So what's the fix?
To skate effectively, you have to dramatically bend your knees, sink your hips, and bring your center of gravity closer to the ice. It feels terrifying to a beginner, but it is actually the most stable position.
What are the other disadvantages for adults?
We have significantly less free time to log practice hours. Our tissues recover much slower from micro tears. And perhaps the biggest hurdle is the massive ego hit.
Oh, the ego hit is huge.
It is incredibly humbling and embarrassing to be a successful 40-year-old professional in your daily life and then step onto the ice and be visibly the most incompetent person in the room. Many adults quit simply to protect their ego.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Adults also have massive advantages over kids when it comes to learning.
Absolutely. The biggest advantage is cognitive maturity. Adults can instantly conceptualize and understand complex spatial systems. You can hand an adult an article on a 1-2-2 forecheck system. They can read it, understand the geometric angles, and immediately execute the theory on the ice.
While a kid is just skating around.
Right. A 10-year-old doesn't have that abstract reasoning. They have to learn it purely through hundreds of physical repetitions.
Well.
Adults have self-direction. We have the emotional patience to survive the 2 to 5 week dip we talked about earlier because we understand delayed gratification. And frankly, adults have the financial resources to buy well-fitting equipment, pay for dedicated ice time, and hire specific high-level coaches.
Let's talk about keeping those adults on the ice. Let's talk about avoiding the injury trap, because this is where most adult recreational careers get derailed.
What's fascinating about adult amateur sports is that the most common way players get hurt is not from a dramatic body check or a collision with the boards. The absolute number one cause of injury is a sudden drastic jump in training load.
The classic weekend warrior syndrome.
Precisely. Consider a typical adult player. They do absolutely nothing physically demanding for 4 months over the summer. Then the winter season starts, they get excited, and they play 3 intense hockey games in 5 days.
That sounds like a recipe for a torn muscle.
It is a physiological guarantee. When you return from a long layoff, your brain's competitiveness is still operating at 100%. You remember how hard you used to push? Your cardiovascular system might adapt quickly, but your connective tissues, your tendons and ligaments are conditioned at about 40% capacity.
Why do tendons lag behind?
Because tendons and ligaments have significantly less blood flow than muscle tissue. Muscles get flush with blood and adapt relatively quickly. Tendons take weeks or months of gradual progressive loading to strengthen.
So they just snap.
If you ask a 40% conditioned hip adductor tendon to execute a 100% effort explosive stop, it snaps. You have to progress your physical load gradually over weeks, not days.
And while we are on the topic of injuries, we need to completely debunk a toxic coaching myth. The soreness versus pain heuristic. I've heard old school coaches say this forever. If it hurts when you start, but the pain warms up and goes away while you play, it's just soreness and you're fine to keep going. If it gets worse, it's a real injury.
The medical source material is very clear. That is a locker room rule of thumb. It is absolutely not a clinical medical guideline.
Why is it dangerous?
Because of human biochemistry. When you exercise, your body floods the area with adrenaline, endorphins, and warm blood. These are powerful, natural painkillers. You can have a genuine severe tissue injury, a partial tear, that will actually feel better and numb out once you are 20 minutes into a game.
But the damage is still happening.
You are making the tear worse with every stride, but the adrenaline is masking it. Then you wake up the next morning, the adrenaline is gone, the inflammation sets in, and a minor two-week strain has become a catastrophic four-month tear. Use that warm-up heuristic as a prompt to stop and evaluate, not as a blanket license to ignore structural pain.
Let's touch on one final, very specific and vital safety note from the source material. This is regarding the goaltender's mask and the rules around it.
This is a critical rule breakdown that every player needs to understand. The golden rule is never, ever intentionally shoot at a goalie's head in warmups and do not fire slap shots at their head from 10 feet away in practice.
Because it's disrespectful.
Partly, but mostly because it is incredibly dangerous due to a massive misunderstanding of the rule book. Players universally assume that if a goalie gets hit violently in the mask and is hurt, the referee will immediately blow the whistle and stop play to protect them.
But they don't. I see play stopped on TV all the time.
That is the danger of watching the NHL and applying it to amateur hockey. The rule books are shockingly varied. Across the NHL, USA, the IIHF, and Hockey Canada, only the IIHF and Hockey Canada, and even then, only for under 13 youth leagues, explicitly state that play immediately stops for a mask hit where the mask stays on the goalie's head.
Wait, so if the mask gets knocked off, play stops?
Yeah.
But if the goalie takes a 90-mile-an-hour puck to the forehead and the mask stays securely on their head, play continues.
Under the NHL and standard USA hockey rules, yes, play continues if the mask stays on unless the referee determines the goalie is visibly injured. Now, every single rule book in the world mandates stopping play for an injured goalie.
So what's the problem? If they are hurt, the ref blows a whistle.
Here is the terrifying catch specifically for amateur goalies. They wear a full wire cage over their face, not the clear visors that skaters wear. A thick wire cage completely hides the subtle facial signs of a concussion or a dazed player.
Oh, wow. So they can't even see it.
Exactly. A referee standing 20 feet away looking through a wire cage literally cannot see if the goalie's eyes have rolled back or if they have a blank concussed stare.
That is terrifying.
So the referee assumes the goalie is fine, the play continues, the goalie is stumbling around concussed, and they are at massive risk of a secondary impact, which can be fatal. Do not rely on the whistle to protect your goalie in practice. Aim for the pads. Control your shots.
That is a sobering and vital piece of practical advice to end on. Okay, we have covered an immense, sprawling amount of ground today. We are entering our final mastery review. We have looked at neuroscience, biomechanics, statistics, and tactical theory. It's time to build the integrated mental model. Distill everything we've talked about into a coherent framework the listener can walk away with and actually use.
Here is how you build your mental framework for mastering any physical skill. First, accept that learning is fundamentally not a straight line. It is a jagged staircase. You must deliberately embrace the misery of the dip, the 2 to 5 week danger zone where your performance temporarily plummets while your brain builds a superior high ceiling neural pathway.
Right, embrace the dip.
Second, recognize that merely logging hours is an illusion. Practice is not repetition. Deliberate practice requires a highly specific goal and immediate objective feedback. If you don't have feedback, your basal ganglia is just permanently grooving bad habits like head down stick handling.
Don't rehearse your errors.
Exactly. Third, prioritize your skills mathematically, not emotionally. Skating and receiving govern the 99% of the game you are not shooting the puck. Prioritize the painful multiplier skills.
And the final piece.
And finally realize that hockey-like life is a game of cognitive decisions, not just physical execution. A great skill used at the wrong time is an error. Add variables to your drills to force yourself to make a read under pressure and build true hockey IQ.
That is a phenomenal synthesis. If we had to boil this entire deep dive down into a simple, remember these three things, summary for the road, what are they?
Number one, a physical repetition without feedback is not practice. It is simply rehearsing your errors and hardwiring failure.
Love it. Number two.
Number two, how a practice session feels in the moment is a terrible indicator of what you actually learned. Do not judge yourself by your daily performance test. Test yourself cold a week later to see what actually stuck.
And number three?
Number three, the external score sheet is pure noise. Stop tracking outcomes you can't control and start tracking process measures like how many times you shoulder checked to find your true signal of improvement.
Process over outcomes. Let me leave you, the listener, with a broader question to mull over as we wrap up. We've talked about all of this complex theory in the specific context of ice hockey. But look at your own life entirely beyond the ice rink or the gym. Look at your career trajectory. Look at your relationships, your communication style, or your other hobbies.
Where does this apply, right?
Exactly. Where in your life are you confusing accumulating hours with deliberate practice? What bad habits have you grooved 10,000 times simply because you just kept punching the clock day after day, and you never once asked for an outside eye to give you objective feedback? You can't just keep swinging a hammer in the dark and expect to build a masterpiece. Figure out where your feedback loop is broken and fix it. Until next time, keep your head up.